All right, today is August 3rd, 2016. This is the fourth and probably final interview with Tracy Hahn. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Archives, and we are here at the office of the Silver Buckle Press, at least for another few days, in Memorial Library. So Tracy, as we've done with all the other interviews, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, Tracy Hahn, H-O-N-N.
Okay.
Whistle included.
All right, so we're just going to jump in and do Silver Buckle Press today. I think specifically the transition from where it was to where it is now.
Exactly.
So wherever you want to start with that,
okay.
Let's go from there.
All right, I'm ready for it. I had in my notes we were going to talk about the transfer of Silver Buckle Press, and then I have past, future. So,
mm-hmm.
And I'm going to reiterate a couple of things, but it's really just part of that story.
Okay.
That Silver Buckle Press has been part of the UW libraries on campus since 1973. And we've been more or less supported, really depending on who was in the helm, what direction there was from on top. Administratively, Silver Buckle Press has been part of, in order, external relations, library communications. It was standalone for a while as an entity. And in the last few years, it's been standalone, but part of this group that Doug Way formed, which was an affiliation of the special collections entities in the library. So that was good.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to read something from the mission statement that was included on the first broadside printed after the press came to campus here. It says, and Mr. Shafto referred to was the original proprietor. Mr. Shafto's one expressed wish for his collection was that it not be broken up and disposed of piecemeal, that it be preserved intact and be established in and operated by a museum, library, or historical institution. In providing a home for the Silver Buckle Press, the university has become the fulfillment of that wish. It should be emphasized, however, that the press, despite its historical significance, is not intended as a museum piece, but rather as a working tool to be used to support instruction and to provide material access for a limited group of interested persons to the craft of hand press printing. I'm sure that was written by Robert Runzer, who was the chief bibliographer of Michigan State University libraries, and we have a number of things in the archives that were printed by him for those libraries, but I think he was a really good writer. And when I got the job, I really studied that statement. It wasn't used actively anymore in any kind of PR stuff that we had. One of the first things I did was work on getting a really good brochure for the press. That was a few years after I'd been here, but I saw that we needed something like that. And along the way, in trying to say what I did and what we were and establish all those things, looking at that statement seemed like the right place to be, and it was so beautifully written. The way I interpreted it was preservation through use. I certainly didn't come up with the phrase, but I really leaned on it heavily. And this particular phrase is kind of implied, but it's working museum. So I would say to people, it's a working museum. We use the collections for teaching and demonstration purposes and printing. It's not just kept behind glass, right? So I also really worked on trying to embed the press in library activities. I worked closely with other librarians or staff members in the libraries to promote what was maybe going on in their collections or to collaborate with them, most closely Lynn Krinick in the art library and Robin Ryder and Jerry Lodotti for a short time in special collections, but others as well. I wanted to talk about a program that I did that really maybe represents that. And it was not a big thing, but we had two very small printing presses in the collection that in my tenure and when I was a student at the press were never working. They were just around and they're very cute. So I committed to fixing them up and in the process, of course, had to learn more about them. Little Platen presses, learned that there's no better word for them than small printing press, which I really love. And I learned that from Elizabeth Harris, which is where everybody learns anything about the subject first. But they dovetail really beautifully, those presses, with a collection here in the libraries. So what those 19th century printing presses allowed for was personal printing. It was the first time private people could buy printing presses and have one in their home. So the paper I wrote and presented on the subject to the American Printing History Association later was called Desktop Publishing in the 19th Century, because they really let people do something new. And it spurred this huge activity that started really post-Civil War called amateur journalism. And there is a huge collection of amateur journalism that came during Robin Ryder's tenure here in the libraries. It's historically an important collection because it was actually put together and bound in like 1908. It's the Edwin Hadley Smith collection. So, but it meant that I could talk with library school students on a tour. I could have them work those printing presses. I could have a facsimile of one of the pieces that were in the collection upstairs, or indeed we could go upstairs and look at the kind of journals that people wrote. And it really dovetails more when I started working with them than now. I don't see, people aren't blogging quite, or there's something sort of changing, I feel like, with social media, but blogging was everybody had started a blog at the time I was working on these a few years ago. And it's common with blogs that you really get into it and you do a couple and then you don't do anymore. Well, these papers are the same thing. There are just a ton of titles that are number one, you know, volume one, number one is really common, or that they would only be issued a few times. But their interests, the differences, the similarities, the shout outs, the sort of blog roll, there are so many really fun comparisons to look at. And it's all about history of communication, you know? So that was something that I did that was both press collection related, but then in a broader way, other collections here and trying to teach well with them. In 2008, I offered a summer seminar, it got a big name from a little thing, and it was two students who were interested in interning here, and I really didn't have the kind of time I thought it might take to give them internships at the press with the things I was doing otherwise. But I had been, with this press, fixing up presses, wanting to work on next, this slightly larger Platen Press, a Golding official, it's called. And, you know, sometimes you think you have to make yourself fit in a box, and then you realize you can make those other things fit in the box you have. Do you know, it was kind of, some of the sweetest things have happened because you get an idea and you actually allow yourself to do it. So it was realizing I didn't really want to do what I thought those students probably wanted me to do for them. But if they would get on board with something I wanted to do, which was, and then I really thought about it and organized some teaching around fixing up that press. So there were about four students, two weren't even enrolled at the UW, had no connections except they were volunteering at Tandem for the summer. Two colleagues, Robin Ryder and Michaela Sullivan Fowler, who work with special collections. And I had a student on staff at the time, former student that I was able to hire for a year, Kathy O'Connell. And there was a special collection student. It was a very small handful of people. I'd had a grant that I hadn't fully spent out from the Friends, and I asked them if I could use part of the monies to continue this project, which was meeting weekly with this group. We started a blog, worked on fixing up the Platen Press, traveled to this place called the Platen Museum in, where Paul Aiken, it's a private printing museum that's extraordinary in Northern Illinois, and we all got to operate a linotype typesetting machine, which is phenomenal. We also went up to the Hamilton Woodtype and Printing Museum and did a little bit of work up there just for a couple of days. So 2008, it was important because that museum, Hamilton, had been formed approximately 10 years before that. And over those 10 years, I'd been in touch, but not very closely, and it seemed like you had to have some special entree. I couldn't quite figure out the sort of, it was a little mysterious to me, but I met the current director whom I'd corresponded with before. His name was Greg Corrigan, very sweet about accommodating this group that I brought in and giving us tours. And it was really a good experience. But it seemed a little sleepy up there, just ever so. And actually, around that time, this woman who was a UW alum named Justine Nagin, she is a filmmaker. She worked for Kartemkin Films in Chicago, an independent filmmaking production company, most well known for producing Hoop Dreams. And they really do amazing documentaries. I don't know how she first learned about the museum and Two Rivers, but she went up for a visit sometime in the early aughts, I guess, and saw something interesting there. So this Hamilton Museum comes out of what had been this, you know, industrial, huge business there that early on stopped making much wood type and got into cabinet making. But they were a large employer in the area and had a lot of impact locally and beyond. Justine saw this really, this town in decline. There weren't many lines being run anymore. There weren't many workers anymore employed at whatever entity owned the plant. And she made a movie called Typeface. And in 2009, she reshot, before it was, I guess, going out on the circuit for all the film festivals, a little piece about the new director and his brother. So it's Jim and Bill Moran. These are two guys from Green Bay who were like third generation printers. And they had been putting in a lot of volunteer time at the museum. Bill, with some other guys, wrote a really good book about Hamilton and about some of the cool design projects that had been going on that I really hadn't known about in the 10 years before. It's great that she includes this coda interview with them, because the film itself is actually depressing. It's kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe that guy has to go one more time into that place that nobody's visiting and move a bucket because the rain is leaking. I mean, it's really, and then you see the town and driving around, and its release coincided with part of this growth of a movement that I talked about last time of young designers and young people being very interested in printing. And she interviewed Paul Gale at the Newbery, who works with their special collections, and talked about typography. A couple of designers, this Stacy Stern, who's a letterpress printer with a commercial shop, very successful in Chicago. It's a very Chicago-centered, centric piece. I sometimes wish that she'd interviewed more people in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But it's her home, you know, she went where she could, and she had these guys, the Post family, I think they're called, very hip, very exciting, very like all about wood type, all about ink on paper, this kind of hip thing that was happening is in that movie, along with the parts about Two Rivers and the museum. And when that thing got released, it was like a bomb went off in the world of like, whoa, I can't believe this is happening in this little place in Wisconsin, and we're all gonna go there now. In 2009, they had a spring event with the sort of outgoing of Greg and the incoming of Jim and a celebration of their 10th anniversary. And that fall, they had a conference, and their first Ways Goose, and which is a printer's get-together, a term that people use. It's actually in August, the original holiday, the printer's holiday. But it's often used by printing history kind of groups as a way to designate a get-together or some kind of conference. So theirs, which is the first week in November, took off that fall, and it's just sort of never stopped since. The kind of connections they've made and the people who come. And the people who are coming are, you know, like, I don't know, San Francisco designers and a kid down the block and somebody whose dad worked for the company. And it's part of what's exciting about what was happening is you got a lot of young, computer savvy, you know, people interacting with historians and designers who'd been in the field much longer or had a different take on it. And it was really yeasty and very exciting. So exciting for me because I feel like I've helped them, but they've helped me so much because of the people I met there, the colleagues I have. In, I think, 2009, I was invited to be on this artistic advisory board, they call it. It's not an executive committee at all, but it's Jim Sheradin and David Shields, and I probably shouldn't go through them all, but Stacy Stern, one of these people in this film, Typeface, is on their board, and it's Paul Gale. It's been a fun group to get to know, but also they've really relied on a lot of bootstrapping so much at that museum that it's a lesson to people about what you can do sort of with starting with nothing, but really knowing the right person to ask, where do I go next? What do I do? So they got bigger in a really wonderful way. So during that time while, and I really, it's not that I was working there, but I had spent increasingly time there when I could and developed a lot of fun things with them. So simultaneous with that, however, it seemed like none of that was really apparent here. There were certainly a few people on campus who might partake of that. I had an increased sort of presence because of some things I did at Hamilton. Like we got on something called Design Sponge. It was like, you know, one of the best places to go in Madison, it would be here. But that, the impact that I was seeing in the world of what was exciting about letterpress and all this design stuff, it wasn't coming back to me here at home. And, or at least it seemed increasingly sort of isolated here. I wasn't as happy in my job. I didn't feel as effective. And that has really, I would say, continued. That went on. All of my career here, every single year, I have been concerned with protecting this collection. And whether the libraries at some point would just say, no, not anymore. And I don't think it was, I'm sure at times I made that more of an interior argument. I was always worried about if the job I was doing would protect it more, you know, what could I do? And if it wasn't working or if I was really scared, I was sure it was my fault. It took me my whole career to realize you have one, no control, and two, there's nothing you can do anyway. So that doesn't mean I don't think you should self-critique, but I think you shouldn't self-punish. So, and I definitely did that a lot in my career here. In the last some many years, I did a lot of behind the scenes looking around to think, what could the alternatives be on campus for where this place could function? Since I really felt it wasn't functioning at its best here. I also fished former students to see, if it comes the time I really would like to leave, you know, can I make a strong recommendation for somebody who wants this job? And I fished my best students, and they mostly didn't want the job. Didn't seem to think that that was something they would pursue, right? And I don't know if it's they saw too much sausage being made. Didn't talk, you know, down, but I think they did see some of the challenges. I have reason to think that kind of at the sort of in the upper echelons of decision making, let's say, that there's really no understanding of what this could be or is or where it is in the world or what context it's in the world, I guess I should say. So that's even more sort of scary because I might be able to talk about things that we've done that I'm proud of, but if you aren't persuaded that that's at all, you know, meaningful, and if you don't have any reference to interpret that, it's not meaningful. The back channel kinds of things I did, I don't really need to go into all the details of, except that I had, I think, decent ideas. And what was clear to me was that there were parts of the press collection that could be used on campus. But you know, back in that mission statement, that thing about piecemeal, that there was no way you could get a place where you would take care of the collection entire. One of the things I did to affiliate with the libraries while I was here was have a field study student from the library school catalog many of our books that came with the collection. They're increasingly scarce. They're in this category of medium rare materials. Some were original catalog. That was a good thing. That's only a few hundred volumes, and we had more books than that, but I'm saying that because that was part of the collection. It's really extraordinary to work in a place as a printer, a printing history person, where you can be printing with material or designing with things, where you can then go to the shelf and pull volumes, where you can see it in use or you can read its history. It's one thing to know that people use catalogs that way, but it's another thing to have the experience of doing it. And that's an incalculable value. That's a really special thing. The collection has been protected. It didn't go into the art department. That wasn't where Walter Hammond thought, you know, he would recommend it go, because he knew there was some historical significance to some of the items here, even though it's a small collection. And what has been done over all the years of people taking care of it is that they've taken care of it. Using it and taking care of it is not an easy charge. It takes some thought. And this place got used pretty heavily because of not really having, say, a collection budget to increase the collection in any way. So there was a certain staticness to what we had. My feelings about not really being happy is not a very particular word, but certain about the press and the libraries and the world and my own, what I wanted to do, got increased, you know, my own sort of restlessness. So I decided to fish or cut bait and find out something. I chose the worst time. I mean, I knew that going into it, but the budget cuts that have affected libraries in recent years because of the governor have really cut deep. And I see that programs university-wide that I think are, you know, incredible programs like the Dictionary of American Regional English. You know, they've come to a certain point where it makes sense that perhaps they could stop, but the research projects there are vast that could go on. And as you know, they're packing up and their mm-hmm. things are moving to archives, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm lucky. That's all I can ever say. But I see that, you know, and that's also the life of an institution. I know that things come and go, but it was always a concern to me. So I wanted to know what the libraries would do if I left. I didn't say I was leaving, but I just floated it. So apparently the executive group and committee at the library had this on their agenda via my boss, and who hasn't been here a long time, so he's the head of collections here. And he told me that they met and they discussed this, and they said that I was doing a great job and I could stay as long as I liked, but when I left, they would not replace me. They did not want to shut the doors on the collection. They found that a repugnant idea, which I appreciate. And they asked if I would advise them at that point in the disposition of this collection. So that was really devastating, but it was also liberating. Because it was sort of like the thing that you think it's the worst thing that could happen, happened, as far as I was concerned. And then it just made me really serious. I saw that a door was open also. I was trying to think today exactly the right order of things, but I will say this. I talked privately to three people around this time. And they're my gems. I have a lot of gems in my life. But they were people that I thought could speak to particular pieces regarding this change. I remember, maybe I better say what the change is before I get there. But I already knew that there wasn't any place on campus that this collection could go. And I knew I didn't want to stay. Those are horrible circumstances in any case to stay under. And that was like, I knew I was leaving immediately or as soon as possible, given that. I did not want this press closed on my watch. It was my, that hurt me more than anything. And it helped in a way to realize my loyalties were to the collection, mm-hmm. right? My loyalties weren't to the libraries. It was the only way it could be. Mm-hmm. After I realized I was just gonna, I had to go, and I got that news, I spoke with my friend Jim Moran at Hamilton. And almost the first words out of his mouth were, "We want the collection." And that changed everything. I went to, very quietly, to Jim Dast, who at one time took care of this collection. He worked in the libraries for many years. He's retired from the preservation department he helped begin, right? The conservation lab he started. And he's a longtime Friends member, a group that's been very supportive of the Silver Buckle, and a friend. He was my teacher and friend and boss. And Jim was like, "Of course." As soon as I started to tell him the story, he said, "Of course. Absolutely." And I was nervous, you know, it's a really hard, was very hard for me. Jim Danke was the other person I spoke with because he's this print culture person. I've known him a long time. He worked for the society. And I know he's not sentimental, which I kind of needed both, right? And he got it. He was like, "Yes, that's a great idea." The hardest one was Jim Escalante, my friend and colleague in the art department, whose students, first of all, he also studied with Walter Hamady, so we have that in common. And it's been an important connection to the art department, for the art department. Historically, it has had that, and in an ongoing way, it does. So the person it probably cuts most is Jim. And he got it, but I think it's still really painful for him in a way it doesn't continue to be for me, because frankly, I'm not going to be here, right? Mm-hmm. It's, to close the collection is a loss. To take it somewhere else feels perhaps like more so, but I think what I help facilitate here is the best thing we could have done. That doesn't mean it's not painful, and that doesn't mean I don't have privately ideas about what I wish, whatever. I'm not looking back. I really couldn't afford to. And the hardest part of this for me was that the negotiations throughout which I was so respected by administration in this library, more than I have ever been, ironically. They were kind to me, they kept me at the table, they listened to what I had to say, they took my advice. That's exciting. That was somewhat novel. I don't mean I've been badly treated, but we have been neglected, let's say. And I'm not a squeaky wheel. That's probably part of the neglect, I would say, if I'm self-critiquing, right? Okay. So I had a point in that, saying that they were kind to me. Oh, the negotiations took a lot of work. And my understanding, and it makes sense to me, was that it needed to be done very quietly. They wanted to move as quickly as they could. They were really mindful of sort of what the pitfalls might be. I don't think, from what I could see, ever wanted to disrespect anybody or acted callously. They were really thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And during that process, that was the summer of 2015 until January of 2016, I knew this was in progress and happening. And I did not tell anyone. I really didn't. I don't. Um, nor did Hamilton. They negotiated a long-term loan of this collection. It's 10 years. The expectation is that it will be renewed and stay there, and that it's not coming back. There were faculty, I know, who were upset and disappointed, understandably so. And I think within the library, probably even regarding me, there was a kind of, I mean, I think it's heartbreaking for people who care to have it leave. It's, but they weren't included in that discussion. That wasn't my call, but I definitely was what I had to do. In their place, I would also have felt left out. In my place, I see it wouldn't have made any difference. And it probably would have caused more heartbreak and sorrow. I mean, there were these times when I thought at the beginning and throughout the process, should I have, you know, what, tried to have a rally, all the stuff. I mean, you can see all the things you could try to do to salvage something like this. But the day in, day out, overhead, hiring a staff member and keeping these doors open, you're either committed to that or you're not going to do it. And there's no effing in between. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have been a party to that. The not cherry picking thing, I was really insistent on, and I prevailed. The books that are cataloged are still cataloged. They will be up at Hamilton. They never circulated. They were a locked collection. Now they're going to actually, in a sense, circulate. If you on campus here wanted to call one of those books, you could have it pulled and it would go to special collections here. So that's actually more access than you had before, because I wasn't always here. I didn't. Those books never got heavily used. Let's be, you know, there's only so many of them, and there is some interest, and there was, but people will still have access. The libraries have some strategies for continuing to stay connected to this collection. One of the things I did was negotiate a relationship between Hamilton and the UWDCC, which is the UW Digital Collections Center, right? So they, over the years, had, they were one of the best outfits to work with, but I had started having some of these 19th century type materials from our libraries. They had done the digital scans of those and the metadata for them, and we have a really beautiful little library up there that's used heavily. That's really heavily used. The stats on that are interesting to me. Hamilton has both a library of similar kinds of items, but they have these, I had worked a lot with their ledgers. I packed their ledgers and books when they moved from the old space to the new, and so I'd had my hands on them a lot, and or enough. And they have these 19th century ledgers that are unique, and they also have a lot of embedded history that people want to get at about the business and the company and what was going on with these businesses in the 19th century that made wood type. And I got that too. So UWDC has now, representatives from there have been up to Hamilton. And the get is simply that Hamilton will start to flow materials into a Hamilton collection, that it seems win-win. The UW will host those, and I think they're significant and will get a lot of use. Hamilton, of course, has this opportunity for professional and, you know, a university-connected, mounted place to disseminate more of their materials. It's also going to be a way, it seemed to me, that if the libraries want an ongoing relationship, when you have something like that that has annual deadlines or even mid-year, you know, things where people have to talk or flow, that there's going to be someone on staff here who knows somebody on staff up there. And it I think, is good for continuity, because as I pull myself out of this, which is happening in the next month and a half or 2 months, I I'm not going to be here to sort of, you know, that everybody can pivot around that. So I'm trying to make sure everybody meets and gets on board with each other. I haven't talked at all about moving. And the whole press releases and retiring. You good?
Yeah.
Those press releases that went out in January and then shortly after that were big in terms of getting that word out, and there was sort of a lot of drama for a while, but it seemed like everything fell into place, and I was glad not to have to be that I couldn't talk anymore about what was going on. And it was up to Hamilton to do the big move of the presses and cabinet, so I've just spent a lot of time helping Jim coordinate that and talking on the phone and checking out our, you know, the loading dock, a place I know well. And I took books up there myself in the spring, early, maybe February, March. Then the big move was the end of March, beginning of April, which with presses and type. I just took the last of a big van up that were some small pieces of equipment that just wouldn't fit on the truck. What Hamilton was doing on their end was setting aside a room for us and building it out a little. I knew what space Jim was interested in. It needed to be a locked space. It will continue to be. And they did that. And what the press will be at Hamilton is it offers them an opportunity to teach handset, which they didn't have. They do a lot of teaching up there. They have a great classroom that I've taught in, but they would like to expand their offerings for printing, and this makes it possible for someone to come in who has a background in fine printing and would really like to teach at a kind of at a higher level for printing with students. And I, to get everything settled, I just need to do a little more work up there in the room so that it's really set up for that kind of activity, which it wasn't in the past. We weren't regularly teaching six students at once how to typeset. So physically there's some challenges with the space that I, just some problems for me to solve that involve things like building a shelf and nothing horrible. I was up there for a week in June, and I'll be going up for another week, it looks like, in September. I'm hoping I'll continue to be connected to this collection, but not formally, right? I'm not on the payroll anymore at some point, and I would like it to be at a place where, you know, if I went to Timbuktu for a year, nobody would need me. And they shouldn't have to. I'm happy to advise, but I'd really like it to be at a point where nobody has to ask me permission about going into the room, which Hamilton's been very deferential on making sure it's set up the way we want. And I really appreciate the respect that they have shown the UW and the regard for the collection and the kindness. But that, it's not quite there, and that's right now in my life here at the end. I really want to see that through properly. So I'm kind of counting the days and scheduling things on a calendar, and I want to see that finished. I really underestimated how much time it would take to set the room up, frankly, because it's a little smaller and a little more challenging a space just for setting it up the way we want to. It's going to be fine, but it was just a lot of parts of my brain that had to be, you know, really engaged. Mm-hmm. I think I should let you ask me a question about that if I didn't say anything, or about this whole transition, because tend to condense things sometimes down to really fine. Yeah, I don't want to leave out some big picture item.
Right. I'm going to take a moment to look at this.
Sure. I can add one thing to it.
Okay.
There will be a formal grand opening. So there will be a time where people will be invited to go up. I know the libraries, I think I started to say this before, want to facilitate some kind of annual trip there's a little bit of a gift fund that I had that those monies will roll over towards, which might be helping to support students to go up for a day or two to take classes. It's 2.5 hours. It's hard to go up, take a class, and come back the same day. So either travel or lodging or some kind of support for students. I know that Jim Escalante and Art will be their point person for that. And that kind of event where they actually have an opening where staff would be invited and we'll have some demos or things up there for people to see will be possibly April, but in the spring. Mm-hmm. This summer, at the end of the month, on Saturday, the 27th of August, there's the closing of an exhibit up there, and it's an exhibit of Silver Buckle Press work. It's up now. Mm-hmm. And they generally have opening receptions. This year they're having a closing, but they invited the libraries to participate in whatever way they wanted, and we'll be putting out just a co-announcement. It's really Hamilton's event, but there may be some UW people going up for that. And it's more of a sneak peek behind the scenes because the room, although it can be seen, it's really not sort of ready for its close-up, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's a pre-event in a way. Yeah. So that's
I guess really my only question, and I think this could wrap this up, mm-hmm. depending on what else you want to say, is so it's gone. I mean, we're now in an empty...
Pretty much.
It's not a completely empty room, but...
Full of a few archive boxes and cartons. Right, it's gone.
So how would you explain its legacy to somebody who you know, came to you next year, mm-hmm. or in 5 years? Its legacy here.
On campus.
On campus, or maybe even more specifically, its legacy here within the library space that it encompassed.
I would say that we were a printing history museum that were part of the libraries that functioned to help students and anyone interested in knowing more about hand press printing learn. That it was a place of refuge. There were many people who, when they got here, they would walk in the door, even if they hadn't known what they were going to see before they got here. But there was a certain person who would walk in, their eyes would light up, and it was like they were home. For former graduate students, especially, I there is definitely a living legacy of people for whom it was a deeply meaningful space. Sort of the why or wherefore almost doesn't matter to me in the scheme of things that way. I mean, it was a UW thing. That's the part that's hardest probably for me to talk about because it is gone. Maybe you have to ask me in 5 years. It's why thinking the last thing I did here would be to close the space was the most horrible idea to me professionally. But so for me, that it's not on campus is hard, but it is somewhere, you know? And that legacy goes with it. It will be something different at Hamilton. There will be different kinds of students. It won't be a particular UW-only thing. I think that's good for the collection. If I look at the statement about it, it's in a museum. It's going to be used by people who care about it. It is a specialized thing. And it's in a place where people are coming there only for that. So it has an opportunity to live in the world now in a way it didn't here. It won't have it'll have a different kind of environment of only people who are interested in printing being around it. I loved, actually, that it was in the libraries. I think that's one of the best things about its legacy on campus. It wasn't just part of its thing. It was here to support and serve a bigger thing, the libraries and the university itself. And I took that really seriously. And that is a good legacy.
You seem to be at peace with it. I think you've alluded to this in some of the stuff you said, but how did you get there?
To feeling peaceful about it? Well, it's a good thing. If it weren't Yeah, I can't really imagine, Troy, if what, you know, we probably wouldn't be having this interview if all these things hadn't happened. I think what makes me feel peaceful is I think because I pursued what I thought was right, I knew who to ask when we needed help. That's my, that was my investment, you know? Nobody really cared. And when I started those relationships with people at Hamilton, I thought I was helping them, right? So that's okay. If it comes back in that way to you, something you did in your life and your career, why, I, of course I'm at peace, you know? I think anything can happen, you know? There are lots of risks. And I don't really watch football, but I know what a Hail Mary is. And I have the deep pleasure of having gone for something that seemed to me really bold and hard, and having it be not only successful, and this is important to me personally because it's more my style, that I got to work with people. I wasn't working against them. I got to bring people on board to do something kind of wild and risky that in the scheme of things is really not so scary, and it's good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I feel really, really good about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tracy, is there anything else you want to say?
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
It was an honor.
There are other things we could say, but it seems like this is a, anything else would seem anticlimactic at this point.
I agree. And it's really, it is, I'm really grateful to have the chance to talk with you.
Well, I was too. So thank you. And this concludes the Oral History with Tracy Hahn.
Cool.